Scalera. I'm a comic book writer. You probably know some of my credits, but you probably also recognize my name from Wizard. I'm also the creator of a whole bunch of photo reference material. These are my Twitter handles and hashtags for today are NYCC, at Making Comics. I am, like many of you, a fellow geek that is a 12-year-old Buddy Scalera on Christmas morning opening a box of comic books. The one in my hand is Jonah Hex, but I'm a geek in many different ways. That's a microscope, and if you are old enough to know what that is, those are Mego SWAT figures, so guys that are my age understand what that is. These are some of the comic books that I've written, some of the mainstream credits. Some of you may recognize, some of them you may not. And these are my photo reference books, which I will be selling here in the room and back at my table at C5. Me, like everyone else here, is here. None of us get paid to do this. So if you enjoy what we're doing, please buy our books. And one last thing, you can hand that. I made up t-shirts this year. That's my poor wife who had to sit there wearing t-shirts. So for the women in the audience, I made t-shirts that say girls like comics too. They're limited, I don't have that many, so if you want them, I'm selling them here. This is Matt, my lovely assistant, and he will be here helping us. If you have a question, I'm generally not looking out of the audience. You want to get Matt's attention, he will help me to determine who it is that's going to come up next. So, we live off of applause. This is our first panel, was Comics Hollywood Creators, What You Need to Know. We just had that one, it was great, sorry you missed it. Editors and Editing is what we'll be up against next. We will be having a one-on-one with me and Jimmy Pamiani, like inside the Actor's Studio, inside the Creator's Studio. By the way, you can take pictures anytime you want. I encourage it as long as the guests are okay with it. Later on after that, page one, panel one with a team of A-list creators, and then Creator Connection for those of you who have begun the Creator Connection. It's sort of like speed dating for shy people and creators. And this is New York Comic Con. Here's our Friday schedule. We just completed this one, so we're going to move a little bit down. We are here with Editors on Editing. So, once again, thank you very much for coming. This is a panel that goes from 12:45 to 2, so you guys don't have to give short answers if you don't want. First, let me introduce Scott Halley. By the way, when you guys like things, you can laugh at jokes and you can clap a lot. So, yes, thank you. My first guest is Scott Halley, who I have known for many, many years. He has been writing many of the books that I've come to enjoy. He's got a great dark sensibility, which he has brought to Dark Horse as an editor and as a writer. He has created some of the most important, edited some of the most important properties that they have there. And I'm not very good at introductions, so please welcome Scott Halley. Chris Ryle has been working with IDW since the very beginning, and he has...
Almost, anyway.
Well, to me, it's from the very beginning. Almost from the very beginning.
Well, Jeff Marriott was there ahead of me but for about a year, but I've been there just about 10 years now.
Just about, so pretty long time. Yeah. For the IDW company, which publishes some of the most wonderful comics that you could ever find, including some awesome licensed properties, including Bone, please welcome Chris Ryle. So Warren Simons, who I knew from Marvel Comics when he was just a young cub coming up, and then came over to Valiant Entertainment, Valiant Comics, I should say, and is creating some really exciting new comics, reviving some of the comics that I grew up with in the 90s, if you would please welcome Mr. Warren Simons. So one of the things I wanted to do before we get started was I plucked a couple of these off the internet, and then I also had the guy send me a few things. Some of them are obviously tagged with some details, but I would just want to ask each one of my editors here to first just explain what we're looking at here on the screen. So, Scott?
The top left, your left image is an image that Rebecca Isaacs did. We're announcing Buffy Season 10 this weekend, and this is a cover to the first issue of Buffy and the first issue of Angel and Faith, retailer incentive variant cover kind of thing. Below that is my creator-owned book, Devil's Footprints, set in my hometown in Massachusetts. And then Solomon Kane is a Robert E. Howard character that I wrote for a while. The big image on the right, my current writing gig, is Abe Sapien. I co-write that with Mike Mignola. We work with these great artists, Sebastian and Max Fiamara from Argentina. And that's a cover by Max for an upcoming issue.
Great. The clapping thing. don't you tell us what we're looking at on the screen? I think you provided all of these for me, actually.
Yeah. So the top left is Bone. That's one of the latest artist editions we're doing. And if you're not familiar with our artist editions, it's where we're basically taking the artist's original art boards and scanning them in full color. So you're picking up all the flaws and the whiteouts and the pencil lines and the blue lines and the notes, the colors and all of that, and doing them at the full size. So that's one of the latest ones that we're doing, Bone. Should be out in just a couple weeks. Wild Blue Yonder is one of the newer creator-owned books that I'm really proud of. It's a book that Zach Howard is drawing the hell out of. This is one of the more gorgeous things that we've done in a long time. Good, fun, high-adventure book. Wraith is Joe Hill's follow-up to Lock and Key, and it's also a follow-up to his novel Nosferatu, which came out earlier this year. This is telling the backstory and sort of a side story to the main bad guy that was in his novel. The Max we're doing with Sam Keith. We're doing just classic Max right now, but we're recoloring all of it. We've been working on Sam for 10 years to try to get him to do new Max. He's doing new covers for the thing, so he's kind of weakening, but not to a degree of actually doing new stories yet, but we'll see how this goes. And then the bottom left is John Byrne's newest superhero book, Triple Helix. That's four connected covers that he wanted to do in the style of his old official handbook covers from the 80s. And the other image in the corner feels very self-serving. I only put it on there because Dave Sim did that in a book he's doing for us. He did these big, cool credit blocks, and I just thought seeing Dave Sim draw my name like that in kind of a Will Eisner-y sort of way, it was too cool not to use. So
good. Very good, right? Thank you. And Mark, can you help us understand what we see on the screen here?
Yeah, these guys are smart enough to put the trade dress on. I just sent them the art. So on the left, we have Shadowman. With issue 13, Peter Milligan, the great, brilliant Peter Milligan, takes over the book. And he's going to be launching a new arc with the artist Roberto Della Torre. It sort of is a continuation of the book and Peter's new interpretation of the character. We're all really excited about that. The beautiful cover right there of Bloodshot and the Hardcore is by J.G. Jones. That's a book called Bloodshot and Hardcore by Joshua Dysart and Christos Gage, with a beautiful interior pages by Emanuel Lupacino. And what we've seen is, at least in the context of the fictional world, Bloodshot and the Hardcore join together and they form a team. On the top right, we have a beautiful image by Andy Friedman for the book Harbinger. Andy's a New Yorker artist, so we're super excited to bring him over and have him do some work for us. We're kicking back and forth ideas about it. We just wanted to sort of capture what it would be like not to be a superhero or a guy fighting crime or a teenager, but just capture what it's like to be 18 and listen to your favorite song. And I fell in love with the idea. So I think Andy knocked that out of the park. And then we have Eternal Warrior right there, another beautiful cover by J.G. Jones. And that's by Greg Pak and the incredible Trevor Harrison. And on the right, we have fan favorite Archer and Armstrong by Fred Van Lente, and that cover's by Clayton Henry. And the nice bull mass back there is the 1%. So it's a surreal kind of awesome book by those guys. So that's part of our line right now.
Just a quick show of hands. How many people here are primarily writers? All right. And primarily artists. Okay, so let's start with a writer's question. Guys, considering how many people in this audience are writers and or aspiring writers, first, can you help them to understand how people can properly submit ideas and or portfolios as writers to your company? Do you want to start, Chris?
Yeah, and it's been tough for us. We've sort of had a no-blind submission policy for a while now for writers, and we've just taken art samples. But we're actually working to change that soon. We have a new editor in that is going to be handling submissions and developing more content that way. So it's been tough. I mean, for the most part, you come to us with published credits, and that's how you get on other books from there, or we try you out on things like backup stories here or there. But we so far haven't had a wide submission policy, but like I say, that's going to change very soon. What we're looking to do, and what I like to do on anybody that's pitching me, is start very small. A lot of people, when they have submitted blindly, and I get a lot of blind submissions over email, they'll send attachments that are 10 pages long or 5 full scripts. And I think the tendency is for people to want to show that they can really write and that they've got all this done and they've thought about this world to such a degree that they've got all of this huge document. And it just, there's no way anybody's ever going to read that. So I always get people to try and just build sort of like a pyramid. Start at the top and give me just, here's the hook. Here's what this story is. If I say, yeah, it's kind of cool. What is it? Then you flesh it out and give me a paragraph. And then from there, if you get us asking questions, what happens next? Or, you've got our interest in that way, then we're going to want you to flesh it out. But it's always better at the start to give just a little bit to get people paying attention and to give them something that they can, you know, reasonably read in a day. Just the longer it is, the less likely it is going to get read at the start.
That's good.
But, are they going to clap for that?
Yeah, they can clap.
My advice is always just to do a ton of work. Your buddy Dave Sim said that everybody has 300 bad pages in them, and I think that's generous. Whether you're a writer or an artist, you've got a lot of bad work at the beginning of your career that is not going to get us to hire you. You need to do that work, get that work out of your system, learn by doing it over and over again. I see writers, I see artists who they've drawn 10 pages of comics and they think they got the hang of it, and so they're ready to take over Hellboy from Mignola, and it's not going to happen. Like, you do a lot of work and get better and better at it and start small. Like the pyramid thing you're saying, I get what you're saying, and my kind of way of looking at that is, like, do 8-page stories. If you're starting out and you've got this great idea and you're ready to tackle your 300 issue epic, you're probably not ready to tackle your 300-issue epic. Like, you need to hone your craft by doing 8-page stories, do short stories, do things that you're going to be willing to throw away because you're going to want to throw them away. If at an early point in your career you launch into what you think is going to be your masterpiece, you're going to be getting better so quickly. If you're working hard at this, you're going to get better so quickly that you're going to look back on work from 6 months ago and hate it. So do small things so that it's not so painful to look back at it and hate it. And then when you've got 6 or 7 great 8-page, 20-page stories that you've done maybe with different artists, you know, if you're an artist, you've worked with different writers, you've got this little body of work, and maybe you haven't published it, maybe you've put it online, you've done little ash cans, you've handed it to us when you come to a convention. I need to be able to see good work you've done. One terrible submission moment for me was years ago, somebody pitched me a Buffy story, and it was a great idea. I was like, oh, cool, yeah, all right, let's do it. I start working with him. He turns in the first script or something, and the dialogue was horrible. And maybe you can have bad dialogue on the Avengers, but you can't have bad dialogue in Buffy. Like, it's just not Buffy anymore unless the dialogue's good. So I was like, crap, this guy had a good idea. He is not the guy to pull it off. And now, if I ever kind of do that idea with somebody else, I've screwed this guy. So it's made me real gun-shy about reading submissions unless I know I'm excited about the writer's work.
Now, before I let it be late, you go with the microphone.
No one's going to clap for that.
No. you do have a submission section on Dark Horse?
Yeah, Dark Horse does. On the website, we go to the website, look at the submission guidelines. There is a spelled out policy for how to send stuff in electronically, I believe, as well as through the mail. Everything eventually gets looked at. We don't necessarily respond unless we're going to respond positively, because there's just so much stuff coming in, it would be 2 full-time jobs to keep up with it.
And one quick caveat to that, too, is know who you're submitting to. Well, I get a lot of pitches that are sent that I can tell were sent to Scott and to Marvel and to Oni and to everybody else. And it, like, I don't do superhero books, and I don't do a lot of the things that I get pitches for. So just sort of tailor your pitch to the publisher so we feel like you really get what we do and we see that what you have would fit alongside what we already published.
That's really important because we're all so busy. If we can tell we're being sent boilerplate, We got other stuff to do, you know. If it's that clear that it's just like, hey, Scott, blah 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 blah, you know, and like if we can tell because we see so much of this, definitely be educated about who all the publishers are.
Did you guys hear this? Or do they need to turn the volume? You hear okay? You need to go up.
We hear you.
You hear me? Well, I'm very.
You guys hear me? There we go.
All right. Matt, can you just the red knob to the right there? We'll bring up the. Warren, why don't you tell us, right now we're still in writers.
Sure. You know, it's interesting because I approach this from a different angle. My background is as a journalist and a writer, and before I entered the comic book industry in 2002, I was the managing editor of a company named Resume.com, where I worked with a lot of job seekers who were trying to kick down the door, trying to get a job, whether it was in IT or whether it was business or whether it was, you know, across a whole broad spectrum of industries. And I think a really great point that both of these guys make, you know, is Marvel's not going to hire you to fix the X-Men for them. Like, you might have a great X-Men pitch, But if they need to fix the X-Men, trust me, they have a crew of writers up there that they're probably already going to go to. Like, DC's not going to hire you guys to fix Batman. Like, they knew who they want. If Batman's not working, and obviously right now it is, but if you know, over the course of the history of the company, if the property's not working, they're not going to go to a writer who's never probably been published before to fix the property. So what you guys need to do, and this is super important, is right now on my desk, I have a script from Joshua Dysart, I have a script from Fred Van Lente, I have a script from Robert Venditti that I need to carve out time to get to because we're all so busy. So, like, we're not probably going to get scripts from you guys that are not in comic book form, and it's not an ash can or an eight-page story. Like Scott's saying, you know, get your work done. Find an artist if you don't draw yourself. You know, get a script, do an eight-page story, do a one-shot. Right now, the way the internet works, put it online. Just put it online. You know, just get your work out there and make sure that you're publishing, you're publishing, you're publishing. There's a famous saying, publish or perish. You know, you guys have to get your work, you know, out of just script form. You have to write. I mean, obviously, you know, you got to put the hours in, as Scott's saying. I mean, I heard someone say that you have 10,000 bad pages in front of you.
Jesus.
That's really generous.
Whole career built on bad pages. Yeah.
You know, I lost it.
Well, one quick thing to what Warren was saying, too, about getting stuff published. I know I hear from a lot of writers that they either don't know an artist or they're working with an artist who's kind of shitty. I don't really care about that. Like, if I'm looking at a writing sample, I don't care if the art is necessarily top-notch what we would hire. I do care about the lettering. So actually, like, bad lettering can really drag down a writer and an artist. So if you are getting some pages done, just try and focus on at least lettering that really helps communicate your writing so I can see what you've got. Because, like I say, the bad balloons can really even make the writing somehow seem worse. So.
Well, yeah, what I was going to say is that I agree with all of that. And as a writer, you don't know how to write comics unless you've seen your stuff drawn. Like, you learn so much. You get that first eight-page script into the hands of a mediocre to terrible artist, and you're, once you see what they give you, you're learning so much about how this works. You can't learn in a lab. You can't learn how to write comics unless you've seen the stuff drawn and you start to realize what your preconceptions, where your preconceptions are wrong. You learn so much by seeing somebody even do a bad job of drawing your script.
The first thing I did was Shaun of the Dead. I did this adaptation, and Zach Howard was my artist on it. And I gave him the script, and he goes, dude, panel two says Sean walks in, sits down, takes a drink, and then talks. He's like, that's four panels. I'm like, oh, shit, yeah. I guess it's not really screenplay format. Like, you gotta, like, that sort of thing you don't always pay attention to until the artist is going over it.
Yeah, and there are a lot of great resources out there, obviously, for learning, you know, stuff like that. But yeah, you know, get your stuff onto the page. You know, find an artist. You know, there are a million artists in Artist Alley right now. This is the only industry in the world where you can walk up to the biggest superstar, probably right now. You know what I mean? And go say hello to them, and they'll be responsive and talk to you. And there'll be artists out there who want to work with you. There'll be young artists who are trying to break in. You know, when I was working at Marvel, someone handed me The Last of the Independents, and I read it and I loved it. And yeah. You know, that's Infraction. I started to work together on some stuff. You know, Justin Jordan, The Strange Talent of Luther Strode, someone had to hand that to me, and I read it, and I loved it, and, you know, he began to work on Shadow Man with us. And, you know, I was very lucky at Marvel. I had the opportunity to work on an anthology called X-Men Unlimited, and I got to bring in a bunch of new writers and artists over the course of that. So look for anthologies also. Like, look for anthologies. That's a great place to pitch and to get your foot in the door, because editors probably more likely to take a chance on you for an 8-page story or an 11-page story than they are for four issue limited series, or, you know, assuming you guys are not published, you know, and assume that, you know, you don't have publishing credits underneath you. So the main thing is just to get credits underneath you. You know, I have a couple of interns who work at Valiant right now, and they're still in college, and I'm saying, go to your papers, you know, get clips, you know, go to magazines, get clips. Because when you walk out, it's the same principle. When they walk out of there, they're going to sit down, they're going to apply for a job in the creative field, and someone doesn't want to teach them how to write. They want to see that they can write already. So, you know, it's going to be rough around the edges. No one's expecting, you know, a new writer to be Brubaker or to be Straczynski or to be Mike Mignola or to be any of the, you know, extraordinary writers in our medium, but you have to start somewhere, which is why it's so important to just break away from just, you know, a Word doc on, you know, in your office, you know, and that's all you've got. Because no one's going to sit down and read a 22-page or 30-page script right now. They already have so much to do already, for the most part. You know, editors in this industry are underwater. You know, I'm super lucky. I work at Valiant right now, and I feel like, you know, they place a tremendous emphasis on editors, and they give us space to really dig in, really, you know, work with the writers and the artists closely. But for the most part, I have friends who work at different companies. They're editing 15 titles. They're editing 20 titles. They're editing so many books. that it's becoming almost a production process. So it's very, very, very hard to knock down the door and get in there with a script. But you can hand someone a DPH story and they'll understand it.
Well, I think just to quickly reiterate two good points you guys made is one on Scott's 8-page story thing. 8 pages are really tough. Like 20, 22 pages, you've got room to spread out and sort of even stumble your way to a good ending. 8 pages, you've got to do a lot, introduce character, story, and wrap it up before it's really even got going.
Right.
So, I mean, it's great practice in telling a story. And then also on your point about Matt Fraction and guys like that, even Straczynski and Mignola, these guys didn't start working at Marvel or, you know, wherever they're working now right away. I mean, Matt toiled in the creator-owned field for a long time before he got noticed. Bendis was doing his own thing, you know, drawing and writing his own comics for years before he got noticed. So a lot of guys will come up and go, yeah, I want to write Transformers. And we're not quite, Transformers isn't X-Men, I get that, but you still don't start with your first publishing credit on that. And neither did pretty much anybody that's a success in comics now. They all sort of found their way and did their own thing and, you know, stumbled along the way and got good at this and, you know, ruled out that. And so it is just do your own thing. I mean, you're going to hear no an awful lot from editors. Like, editors' default response is kind of to tell you no because it's easier. We don't have that much time in our days. So that no should then channel you to just, all right, well, I don't need you. I'm going to go do this, and eventually you're going to want me. Justin Jordan didn't wait till Marvel came calling. He went and did his own thing, and then Marvel came calling.
Yep. And, you know, Stephen King's book on writing, well, he talks about the two, like, construction site nails, like those huge nails, and he hammered them into his wall, and he took every rejection letter, and he filled up two of the long nails with rejection letters. So, like, don't wait for me to come to you guys to tell you, you know, you can do it or not. Like, go out there and do it and show me that you can do it. And that's the best advice. You know, you guys gotta publish your stuff. You gotta work with artists. You gotta find young artists. You gotta, you know, try to get a great artist to control your stuff. You know what I mean? But be proactive. Don't wait for the big two or for other company to come and tell you what you can or can't do. You have to take that initiative.
So, we've got a whole bunch of people here, obviously the entire convention. So can you tell these guys the secret of maximizing their convention experience? Now that they know your faces, you guys have pretty much, you know, made yourself, you've revealed yourself, now they know who you are. How can people maximize their convention experience?
I think a great thing to do is not pitch at a convention, but meet people at conventions. Go up to different publishers and say hi, introduce yourself, get to know them, let them, you know your name. And then if you've hit a point where you think you've got something that's worth pitching to them, you know, either you make contact here and say, hey, you know, can I drop you a line in a week? I got this thing I'd like to run by you. Or, you know, sort of do it that way. But it's good to use conventions for the social aspect and also for just the pure aspect of walking around, looking at what is Valiant published, what is Dark Horse published. We don't have a booth, so that's not a lot of help to you here. But, you know, see what everybody's publishing, see what kinds of things they do. If you're an artist, look at the art styles of all these different publishers and see if you know, measure up to what they're doing. And just get to know people. Like, that's really the best way to get hired. I mean, I hire a lot of people that I didn't hire the day I met them, but they're people that you know, periodically drop me a line, or I got to, you know them, whether online or just through different conventions, and just sort of build a relationship that way. That seems to be the best thing I can see to use conventions for.
Yeah, I mean, I generally don't use conventions to look at samples. I have people coming up to me in the booth and saying, hey, can I pitch you an idea? It's like, wow, I would not hear the second word out of your mouth because there's so much going on. My mind is in a million places. Pitching in the booth, pitching in the hallway is ridiculous. You can't do it. If someone says, yeah, go ahead, they're going to tune out. It's impossible to really do it in this forum. But yeah, I couldn't agree more with that. Socializing, making contacts. We want to work with people that are going to make life easy for us to work with. We want to work with talented people, and we want to work with people that we're going to want to have to get on the phone with, that we're going to have these work conversations with. So being personable, having some modicum of social skills, and being able to kind of interact with us, with other, you know, freelancers and artists and stuff, that's what this is good for in a lot of ways. And if you're a writer who hasn't had stuff drawn, the first time I met artists that drew my stuff, I did it here. You guys should be meeting each other. You guys should be getting tips from writers and artists, mostly artists, that can give you really, really useful feedback down at Artist Alley. There, you're going to learn more. You're going to take away more from them than us at a show like this, I think.
Yes, I think these guys both make great points. You know, if you have stuff, you know, I can't even listen to an idea that you're going to pitch me legally. Like, you have to sign a document. You know, it's the same thing that when I was at Marvel, like, I can't hear your Harbinger idea because because you have to sign something called an idea submission form. We have to get that, it has to be processed, and then I can begin to talk ideas. And it's, but as Scott is saying, this is just really isn't a great environment to do that. The floor is jammed, people are bumping into you. It's not an ideal pitch environment. If you have comics, even if it's an ash can that you publish as 8 pages, I mean, it doesn't have to be something through Image or Value or another company. You can publish this on Kinko's, you know what I'm saying? You can go make photocopies of an 8-page story, a 22-page story. It doesn't have to be perfect. It just has to be in the form. I mean, obviously it's ideal if it is small press kind of stuff, that, you know, it feels and looks like a comic, but you know, you can hand that out to different to at the booth. You know, one of the things that I found very useful, or that I saw a lot of people get traction with when I was at Marvel, is some days 40 packages would arrive, and someone went to a comic and they saw every assistant editor, they saw every associate editor, they saw every editor, they saw every senior editor, and they took a package and they wrote down who they were, their address, and they did it 40 times and they sent out 40 packages. And suddenly one day in the office there were 40 of the same thing. It's like, you know, Clay Mann used to do that all the time when I was in Marvel. He used to draw beautiful, beautiful stuff on the FedEx boxes. You know, we got the FedEx box. I'm like, this is amazing. So Clay had sample pages and we were able to work together on some X-Men Unlimited stuff and then a whole bunch of different stuff. But be aggressive, you know, send out the stuff to the company.
I will say something different than that. We often, like, all our mailboxes at Dark Horse, all our mailboxes are this one bank of mailboxes in the center of the editorial department. Every so often I walk by and I see these identical packages in like every one of them, and I'm like, oh, so I don't need to look at this? Randy's got this. I don't need to look at it. Randy, he does the same thing. It's a risky tactic. It might work one place and it might not work another place.
And I just feel bad. Like, a guy's writing, you know, addressing envelopes 8 times, and we all sit right real near each other. So, like, if I get a good pitch or a good art or something, I'll just share it with everybody. Yeah. But sending multiple packages isn't really necessary.
Yeah,
and I think that that's a great point from these guys, just to go show you that nothing is unique. You know what I'm saying? There's no direct way. You know, a work at Marvel might work at Dime, you know, may not work at IDW or Dark Horse. So, you know, it's good to keep that in mind as well.
So, collect business cards at conventions, you know, from artists, from editors, from everybody. And, you know, tell me, hey, I'm a writer. Someday I want to show you my stuff. And leave it at that. Like, great, okay, I've seen your name. I might be more apt to recognize your name when the email comes in later, but that's honestly the most useful thing at conventions.
Can you stand up to answer your question? Go ahead.
Hey, man.
Hey, Chris. Is it better, like, you said the thing about, like, don't send, like, 50 packages, but is it better, like, if you know, oh, at Dark Horse, this guy has the horror books, and I've got a, you know, a horror story that I wrote, is it better to, like, learn who to target?
It certainly helps. I mean, I get guys sending me a lot of Ninja Turtle stuff, and I have a guy who handles Ninja Turtle, so, I mean, finding the editor on that title is the best guy to make contact with.
Yeah, that's all about that education thing Chris was talking about. Know the publisher, know the different editors, know what I'm into and what Sierra's into. But then also, there's the submissions. You know, with us, we've got a formal submissions process. So you send something there, and you have a promise that everything will get looked at. If you send something to me, and we've never had any previous contact, I don't necessarily feel a commitment to give it that much time. I mean, if I open it, if it's art, I open it, it blows me away, obviously, you did your job. It's harder with a script. Like, I don't know which side you were speaking from, but if you're a writer, and you send a pitch to me, and I didn't ask for it, I got to weigh it against a lot of other stuff in terms of what I'm going to do today. And what I'm going to do today is I'm going to get books out on time. You know, that comes first, and man, that can fill up, you know, 70 hours a week. A mix of targeting the right person and following the process that the company puts forth.
It's also honestly a better thing to work bottom up anyway, because, you know, with Warren's job and Scott being the editor-in-chief and my job, we're probably kept busier doing more things throughout the day than, you know, a guy that edits Turtles. I mean, he's certainly working very hard too, but it's better to get stuff to them. They bring it to us and go, hey, I like this guy. I'd like to, you know, try him out on something. But to start with us and then maybe it gets disseminated down to the right editor is usually the backwards approach to take.
Yeah, I think that's a great point. And you know, when I was working at resume.com, just to go back to that, we used to tell people just apply for 3 jobs a day. Like, don't worry about sending out 500 resumes. Don't worry about sending out the 500 submission forms. And I don't want to contradict what I just said a second ago, but, you know, understand who the editor is, what book they work on. You know, understand who you're targeting. If there's an editor that likes horror or has put out a lot of horror work, you know, you want to target that person. That person is just, you know, really know who you're pitching. It's
one of the things that I think you guys sort of were talking about a little bit are things that are good, best practices. And yet, you know, privately after sometimes we're in a bar, we talk about worst practices. What are things that people do to hurt their own career, from deadlines to crappy attitudes and everything in between? What are some of those things that people do to hurt their career without sometimes even realizing it?
So many.
And worth noting, this is a smaller business, a smaller industry than people realize. It might be spread out on the coast, but most of us know each other in some way, and how you can ruin your own career with a person you don't even know.
Well, one little tiny thing I want to get out there. I've recently had interactions with a couple different writers who I think have something going on. And they've come to me and they've been like, yeah, you know, I'm doing this book at Image, but man, I'm just sick of that, you know, BS at Image. And like, you know, a guy starts to shit talk Valentino to me. And I'm like, whoa, I'm done. I am out. Like, if you're shit talking Jim right now, you're going to be shit talking me to Ryle in a month, you know?
Or vice versa.
Yeah, certainly that. But yeah, I mean, don't bite the hand that feeds. If you're trying to impress me, don't try to impress me by putting down the other guys that are giving you work, because you want me to be a guy that gives you work. And, you know, it's very specifically soured me on two guys that I was on the fence with, and now I'm not on the fence.
Yeah, I mean, there's always extreme examples. I had a guy that was sending me a bunch of artwork. I think it was a guy. I mean, it was sort of a gender non-specific name, which is important to the story because, you know, I said, I don't really have anything right now, and he wanted to do Transformers, so it was probably a guy. Yeah. And I said, you know, we've got all these Transformers artists, we're good. That's one thing I do not have any sort of space on and probably won't for a long time. It's a very specific skill. I gave some art critiques, like you're better with humans, but the right angles and everything that Transformers require, you're not quite there yet. And he sent back this scathing email accusing me of racism. You're a racist, you won't hire me. I don't know what the hell color you are. I don't know your gender or your color, and I don't care about that. I care if you're good and if I have an opening. So it's just like, I know you're angry, and I realize, like, all we're doing is telling you guys, don't do this, don't do that. We're going to tell you no. It's hard to do this. It's hard to break in. Like, it gets frustrating, and I know it's a tough business to get into. Any entertainment field is tough to get into. There's tons and tons of people trying to get in and only so many openings, but reacting very badly in a way that has nothing to do with the conversation being had and not listening to the advice is a pretty bad way to go. Like, that name's going to stick in my head for the wrong reason. Right.
When I do portfolio, I remember in Chicago one time I was doing a portfolio review, and, you know, I'm sitting on that side of the table. This guy's sitting here, portfolio spread out. He sits like this. I'm sitting right there. He sits like this. He's like, uh-huh. And I'm like, yeah, you know, he figures, blah, blah, blah. I'm saying something. And he's just like, uh-huh. Yeah. Okay. Just like, oh my God. And I said to him, I'm like, wait, am I wasting your time? And he was like, oh. And I'm like, yeah, no, we're done. The work has promised, but good luck. You know, like, don't show disinterest when you're trying to, you know, that would have been a really bad job interview. And whenever you do get portfolio, the opportunity to do portfolio review, it is job interview. You hope, you know, that's what you're going for. So certainly treat it like that.
Yeah, have a thick skin, you know? Be prepared for rejection, be prepared for a lot of it. And, you know, keep moving, you know? If you're going to sit down with an editor, the editor's going to give you feedback and you're disinterested. No editor wants to work with, like, a genius who is above any criticism. You know what I mean? Like, if something's not working in your story and I say, hey, I don't think this is working, I don't expect the writer or the artist to roll over and be like, oh, you're right. Like, I want to have a conversation, I want to have a dialogue about it, you know? With all the guys that I work with at Pavilion, what we try to do is just, you know, develop a level of trust and try to, you know, create an environment where we can keep ideas around and have a fruitful exchange of ideas. And it's not a situation where, you know, someone's going to cross their legs and not look at me because how dare they critique my art. You know, like, if that's the attitude going into it, don't bother. You know, like, you have to be open for criticism. You have to be open for collaboration. You know, and listen, if someone's running your story into the ground and you hate what they're doing, you don't have to work with them. You know what I'm saying? You can always, you know, move in a different direction, but just be patient, you know? Like, be aggressive and try to get in that door, but be patient. Like, you know, I've had guys blow up, but I remember Marvel, there was an anthology that, like, a bunch of different editors were working on, where there was a contest, and, like, we picked 12 guys, and one guy didn't get picked, and he just absolutely flipped out and sent a letter to, like, all the editors freaking out that we didn't pick him, we didn't know what we were doing, and it was a mistake, and it's like, you know, just, you know, put the rejection letter on the spike and move on. You know what I mean? Learn from the experience.
Which is kind of great for us. Like, it doesn't help that person at all, but it's sort of a fun story for the day, at least. But it's not good to do. If I could tell one other quick nightmare story about, I was doing a portfolio review, and I was sitting with Ashley Wood. If you know Ashley Wood, like, he's sort of an abrasive Australian artist. Very good, like really talented guy, so he knows the stuff. So he sits down, this kid sits down, and stuff wasn't very good. And Ash goes, "This is shit. This is shit. This is pretty. No, no, this is shit too." And he gives it back to the guy, and the guy goes, "Thank you so much, Mr. Wood." And then he comes over to me, and I'm like, "Oh, that poor guy. Like, I'm going to try and help him out." So I'm giving him very specific critiques about his panel selection and his camera angles and his figures and things to fix, like just very specific things to try and make him feel better. And I get to the end, he goes, "What the hell do you know? You're not an artist." So calling it shit was okay, but I go, "I'm not an artist, but I'm the guy hiring artists. So, I mean, at least take my advice as this is what I'm looking for my company. So you may not like what I have to say, but if you don't fix those things, you're less likely to get work at IDW than if you actually listen to what we're saying."
And generate a lot of work. One thing that drives me nuts, and it happens without fail at shows that I do portfolio reviews at, I go to the show and someone sits down and they look vaguely familiar maybe, open up the portfolio, and okay, I look at the first couple pages, and then like the fourth page, I feel like I've seen it before, and then there's a half a dozen pages, and I'm like, "You showed me these pages last year. I didn't give you work. You're showing them to me again, plus these three new pages. So I think what you're telling me is you have drawn three pages in 12 months. Do a lot of work. And if you had samples that were amazing a year ago, keep a little bit of that in. If it's great, it's great. But do a lot of work, and you should be getting better rapidly. I had friends when I was trying to break in, and they were trying to break in. These guys would, like, in June, they would start doing samples. They would bust out four or five pages in June so that they could go to San Diego and show four or five pages. That was all the damn work they had done in a year. They never got any better. They got a little bit worse because they were atrophying for, you know, 11 months at a time. Do a lot of work. Work all the time. It's hard. You know, you might have family, a full-time job, but you've got to find the time. It's not easy. All we're doing is, as Chris said, telling you, like, don't do this, don't do this, don't do this. This is hard. It is really hard. Like, nobody said it was going to be easy. It's incredibly competitive, and you've got to kind of be amazing and work your ass off to make it happen.
Yeah, the hours that the guys work are extraordinary. Like, you know, I've read as a work rate 12, 15 hours a day. Artists will draw the board for 10, 12 hours a day, and then they'll take 2 weeks off. No, I'm just kidding. They don't do that. Sometimes they do.
Nobody gets a vacation.
Nobody gets a vacation. No, but you know, just it's an extremely labor-intensive field for how much the internet has created the transition of files back and forth. It's still a very manual labor process in how comments are created. The script is still created. You know, we create 22 pages of content every 28 days. That's 22 pages of script, 22 pages of pencils, 22 pages of inks, colors, and letters. And we schedule stuff ahead of time so that we're able to build out, and it's not necessarily, you know, an artist having to draw a book in 4 weeks. Like, I don't care if you draw a book in 4 weeks, 5 weeks, 6 weeks, 7 weeks, 11 weeks. I'll schedule around how fast you can move. But by the same token, as Scott was saying, I have to get books out the door. They have to ship. They have to go on time. That means that every 28 days, the new 22 pages should be going out the door. And we do that 6-7 times, so it's intense, intense labor intensive. And you know, one of the things where guys shoot themselves in the foot by more frequently than not is, you know, just finish what's on your plate. You know, just, you know, I have artists who are constantly looking for more work, and they're late and they miss deadlines, and we have to bring someone else in to help out. And guys like that, they get out of my Rolodex as fast as possible. Like, if someone's slow, you know, that's okay, I'll work with you on that, you know, as long as I know. And the other huge, huge mistake that many freelancers make is they don't communicate with their editors, so their editors don't know where they are. You know, like, if you fall behind, if you get sick, if you break your arm, like, that's all cool. Life happens. We all understand that. No one's going to get angry at you. Or at least most rational editors will not get angry at you about that stuff. But, you know, just communicate with your editor so your editor knows where you are in the process.
But the third time your grandmother dies, I know you're lying.
Also,
I know step families, but come on.
Do not refer us to your blog or Facebook to find out what you're up to. Like, there was an artist, a good professional artist who, you know, did a lot of work, and I was trying to find out where their, I'll keep it gender non-specific again, where their book was, and they go, "Well, go to my blog and see what's going on with me."
Like, don't answer me right now. Like, we're chatting right now. I'm not good. I can't keep up with everybody's blogs and Facebook to know what they're...
There's one freelancer where the only way I can get him is to direct message him on Twitter. If I text this person, if I email, if I call, nothing. Direct message on Twitter, it's the only way I can get him. Very talented. The only way you get away with that is by being amazing.
I communicate with Dave Sim only through fax, so there are exceptions to make for people, but it's not everybody.
Western. I think you had a question. Stand up, speak loudly.
Sure. So just, you know, you guys are talking about ashcans, handing you guys ashcans at con, for example. So after I've handed you an ashcan, can I follow up with that, say, in a week or a month or something, just say, how did you like it?
Yeah, and hopefully we'll respond.
Hopefully we'll have seen it. Like, what happens, honestly, at a lot of these shows is it's so hectic at the booths and stuff. There's people handing stuff all day, and they get put into a box of things that are supposed to make it back to us. All the boxes get shipped. I mean, this is a very logistical conversation, but boxes get shipped up. They go back to the shipping company or Diamond, whoever, and then it gets to us maybe in a month after the convention sometimes. So I don't always get it that way, or I don't sometimes see it at all because it gets put in the wrong box or the box gets misplaced or thrown out. So I don't really like taking a lot of leave behinds if I don't have to. It's easier to, like I say, make contact and then send it as JPEG or PDF later on.
Okay. And like, do those ash cans, particularly for writers, do they ever turn into work, or is it more like an introduction?
They have.
They can. I mean, not necessarily that thing, but yeah, you know, anything is possible. The thing about this industry is everybody kind of has a different story about how they went from aspiring to professional. There's not a path to follow, and so there's so many different things. Probably your path is not going to be the path that you envision. You know, whatever you think you're going to make happen, if it happens, it's probably going to be a little different than that. But yeah, I mean, going for it with that, following up is a good thing. Being polite about it, being understanding about the fact that we're so slow.
Yeah, I think when I was at Marvel, I think Danny Way somehow Ashton got into Axel's hands, and I remember Axel showing me Danny Way Ashton's, like, I like this guy a lot, you know. And you know, I think Sam Humphries just did Our Love Is True. I mean, it's a couple of years ago, but that was like an 8-page thing, and both of these things made the rounds and got into a lot of editors' hands, and that led to work. So it definitely can lead to work.
It's also good to get your friends to see them and respond to them and tweet them and put them, you know, spread them through every social media means possible, because a lot of times that's how I find out about something. I see what other people are talking about or what they're tagging, or I get tagged in things. So it's good to very much have a big, you know, online presence that you get your stuff seen that way too.
You want to stand up and ask your question?
Hi there. We've been talking a little bit about what to do for an artist and what to do for a writer. Do you have any advice for people who are aspiring to?
Don't do it.
Run. Yeah.
Oh my God. Join the army.
Yeah, I mean, just rethink where you went wrong in your life, I guess. No, I mean, sort of the same thing. You know, if you love comics and you like telling stories and working with creators on telling stories, like, there are guys, in fact, John Barber, who's now our senior editor, he was at Marvel for a time, and then he left Marvel and was freelancing. So he hooked up with Mark Miller and... I was working on, I think he did Kick-Ass 2 with Mark just on a freelance basis, which you're not going to be able to hook up with Mark Miller on a project, but hook up with the writer and artist and sort of help shepherd a book through, because a lot of times people need someone else to help them see a book through, work with them on story, make sure pages are coming in, and then, you know, you get sort of a taste of what it means to assemble a book, how to get it done, and then, you know, work your way in from there. We've I think 3 to 4 of my editors now started out as interns in the company and then have come up through the ranks.
There was one back there that we've been waiting on. Go ahead and speak.
Hi. I think you started to get at it before aspiring to professional, but what was the moment or opportunity where you guys, this is for everybody, realized that you could support yourself exclusively in comics?
What was the point when you realized you could support yourself in comics?
Well, my first gig in comics was the editor-in-chief at IDW.
So are you getting there? You getting there?
I still live at home.
Right. And, the basement's warm in the summer.
Yeah.
Yeah,
I mean, that's why whenever, like, we sit on these panels sometimes and tell stories of how we broke into comics, and it's terrible because it doesn't do anybody any good other than helping you realize that it's completely haphazard and random and just sort of a thing that has as much to do with timing and circumstance and people you know as it does actual job experience.
With me, when I was in college, I ran the publishing group at it had gone dormant. We weren't publishing anything. I started up the old publishing group at my college, and we generated a bunch of magazines and comics. And then I moved out to Portland, Oregon, walked around, went to every single publisher in town, whether they published a brochure about, you know, leaf pickup, or they published a literary magazine. And I was lucky enough to get a job at a literary magazine by saying, look, here are books that I put together. I did it at school, and they're not very good, and they're stapled, but I showed them things I had done, and that got them to take me on at like the lowest entry-level thing. I did that for a while, and then I started self-publishing. I was writing and drawing and publishing through Diamond and all the other distributors that used to exist, a book that I was hemorrhaging money on. But I was putting this thing out, and I was trying to make something happen, and it was that, from losing lots and lots and lots of money doing that, to being able to hand those books to Mike Richardson and the other editors at Dark Horse, that was what got me the job there. But yeah, from the minute I got the job, I was somewhat supporting myself.
Yeah, I actually applied for a job at Marvel on Monsters.com, believe it or not, and that's my monster story. But yeah, I was working as a managing editor of Resume.com, as I mentioned before, and I was overseeing a network of writers, and I had a background as a writer and a journalist. So, you know, I applied for the job. You know, I came to Marvel one day, I spoke with the vice president of human resources, and then, you know, I later on met with Bill Jemis, and Bill gave me some books to read and to provide written feedback on, and then later on I met with Joe, and I met with David Bogart, and I met with Axel, and I met with Tom Greenberg. And I literally probably went through about 6 months of interviews to apply for the job. I felt like I was getting going to the CIA or something, you know what I mean? But that was my experience. So then I started working as an assistant editor and associate editor and editor. So, you know, I've been in here for about 10 years at this point in time, but you know, I came through editorial. So to answer your question earlier on about how to break into editorial, it helps to have an editorial background. It helps to maybe have worked as an editor somewhere else. It probably helps to have a college degree. It's not a requirement, but a lot of companies, or especially larger companies, will look at it as a requirement. You know, it helps to have clips published so people can see that you can write. You know, many editors are more art-oriented, and many editors are more story-oriented. You know, some are both. But, you know, a lot of times you'll see, you know, all good editors should have an understanding of both. They should have an understanding of story, and they should have an understanding of how panel and page composition works, how to tell a clear story, how to communicate the intention of the writer and the artist, you know, so that the final product is ultimately what they intended and how to improve it and how to work with them. So there are a lot of different things that go into it, but ultimately if you have some kind of an editorial background and you want to break in, you may not go into Marvel on day one, or you may not go into IDW on day one, or you may not go into Dark Horse on day one, fresh out of college, but if you've worked as an editor for 4 or 5 years somewhere else, if you have some background as a writer or artist, that's the way to get
there. I think you were next, didn't you? Okay,
my question kind of goes a little bit to your point of, you know, handing out stuff that you did in college that you knew wasn't, you know, as good maybe as the stuff you're doing. How much can, like, the stories that I've got out there now, I've got about 80 pages done with our work, how much, you know, is it going to hurt me if I show those to people now as opposed to, say, waiting maybe another year or two to get more stuff done?
So I'm sure nobody behind him heard him, but the question was basically, is it better to, like, wait until the work is better to start showing it? Like, if you're starting and the stuff's not coming together, it's not all there yet, you wait until it's better to show to editors? Is that sort of what you're talking about?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's great, but... Okay.
Well, yeah, I mean, but that is key. I think having some objectivity is important, because I definitely see artists that cannot draw at all and don't understand that they can't, that they're not ready to draw Star Wars for us. So having some objectivity, not only believing what your friends or your family say, I think it's good to start by showing your work to other artists. And if they respond really positively, and they're easier to get to, they're all down in Artist Alley, and even the best of them aren't necessarily busy all day at their table. So showing work to artists in Artist Alley and getting a response from them, and if they're giving you a really positive response, then start to show it to us. I try to be really good about this. I think most of us are good about this. But, you know, everybody says first impressions matter. So the first time you show your portfolio, if it's terrible, are we going to remember that forever? I think we all understand that people get better as they go along. But if I'm seeing work that's not improving over a long period of time, then it's like I'm kind of going to tune out the next time I see that person.
Wait, did you say you're a writer?
I'm a writer.
Oh, sorry. I think same point. I think it's a good thing that, you know, showing your work now shows that you got it done. Like Scott was saying before, I think, you know, a lot of people start things and don't finish them. And finishing is the most important thing you can do as a writer or an artist. You know, a lot of people start one thing, go on to the next, one to the next, and never really finish anything. So if you finish your story and then you get an artist to draw it and you take it to its conclusion, like, that shows me a lot more than the guy that just types up a script on a computer and then leaves it at that. Doesn't need to be necessarily where I would hire you, but I mean, it's good to show that and then just keep working.
Yeah, you're going to need feedback. You're going to need feedback, you know, from multiple people. I mean, I suggest you show it, you know, show it around, you know, get advice, get feedback, you know, talk to professionals. You know, portfolio reviews happen, they help, you know. I mean, 90% of portfolio reviews are telling people to work on composition and that, you know, basic things, you know, draw this room, you know, don't draw a guy in a cape, draw a human being, draw a face, draw a hand like this, draw a hand like this, you know, really perfect your graph and work at it. But, you know, I wouldn't keep it hidden. If you want to make a go with this and you want to try to support yourself in comics, you're going to need to get your work out there, and the marketplace is going to have to respond to it.
And if you're an artist or writer, like, show people other than your friends. Like, if you do those things now, even if you're new at it, you're kind of a fledgling artist, whatever, you're still probably the most talented person in your group of friends, unless you hang out with a lot of other writers and artists. And every friend you show your stuff to is going to be like, man, that's awesome. It should totally be published. But that's not really what you want to hear, because your friends are already sort of predisposed to give you good feedback. So try and hook up with other writers or other artists and get sort of unvarnished opinions, as well as, you know, family and friends.
Just love the idea that you're hanging out with Alan Moore, and it's like, oh, this is not good.
Yeah.
Frank Miller, it's like, mad attention.
Could you stand up?
Getting back to the editing question, I work as a freelance editor. I have lots of jobs, mostly journalism and online content, but also with Toronto Comics, which is a nonprofit publisher. So I guess if you have all that, how do you get basically break through the next step of actually getting a full-time job?
Send resumes. I mean, that is something that you can do here. Like, you should be talking to folks like us at a show like this. Ask us if you can send us a resume. Do it via email or whatever. I get resumes all the time, and somebody that has that kind of experience is definitely more interesting. And not even necessarily the comics background that you have. Somebody who knows how to get publications out comes with a great deal of skills that I can't find just like walking around a convention, you know? So if you've got that experience and if it's something that you want to pursue, if you've worked in other areas of publishing, you may be discouraged by the salaries. Comics
are gross. I agree. Send resumes up. This is a good place, you know, at the conventions to go meet and talk with people. Send resumes up.
Right, without having seen more of your experience than what you just described, it sounds like the only thing that's lacking at this point is an opening. You know, it sounds like you've got the requisite experience, it's just there's not that many editorial jobs in comics, so send resumes and just keep an eye on, like, we usually spread word through The Beat or through Bleeding Cool, places like that, when we have openings, just to open it up to people.
Question.
Hi. Before you talked a little bit about interns and how interns can kind of move up the ranks, what do you look for in an intern that might make you feel like you want to give them a chance to kind of keep going?
The fact that somebody wants to work in comics tells me a lot from the start, and just whatever their focus is in school. Like, if their focus is, I don't know, mathematics or something, maybe they're not necessary, but they like comics, that maybe isn't something that they want to do to then build a career on. But if there's somebody that has a background in, you know, they're pursuing a creative degree or they're writing or, you know, something that works well in comics, that's pretty much all it takes to get our attention. And then we, you know, interview people and see who seems like the best fit that way. But just the interest and sort of the future direction of what you want your career to go is all I'm looking for.
Yeah, Josh Shams, who's the assistant editor of Valiant now, was an intern a couple years ago. And Josh worked like crazy. You know, he was the first guy to get. He wanted more work, and he gave him a ton of work, and he wanted more work. And a lot of times I had a story conference with Josh and a couple of other interns, and we just would talk about the story. Maybe I'd give him a pitch to see what the feedback was. And he was always hungry to learn. He was always eager. He didn't come with an attitude. He was just, you know, he was a perfect candidate, so that's why we hired him. So, you know, for me, it's it's just acting professional, it's showing up on time, it's being hungry, it's seeing how you can help out, that kind of stuff. And then it's just big, if there's an open position or not, there are not a lot of editorial positions in the industry, you know, so it takes time sometimes.
And it's unlike freelance, it's regional, right? You're not hiring somebody.
Right. Yep. We wouldn't work with a freelance editor. We wouldn't work with an editor who wasn't in the office. Like, telecommuting is amazing and opens up a lot of possibilities, but my belief is, like, there's so much hands-on work in getting a book out the door. We need editors in the office.
However, if you don't, like, live in Portland, should you still apply?
Is there anybody in comics that doesn't live in Portland at this point?
Well, no, it's like, for example, I live in L.A., but, like, San Diego is Chris and...
Right.
Portland and New York. So, like, is it still worth it to apply for building team?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, for sure. But, yeah. But I mean, I get people who are interested, but they want to be able to stay in, you know, Salt Lake or something. It's like, it doesn't...
Yeah, we all like to work at home and sit on the couch and get paid to do a job, but it doesn't really work that way.
Yeah.
I lobby you guys every day to stop working.
Oh, please.
Hi, Jeff.
Hi.
Thanks for talking
about. Curious,
Scott and Chris, since you do a lot of books that are based on licensed properties, what do you, is there any approach that you take to try and obtain licensed properties, or do they generally come to you? What do you look for? And what
we should make a really bad joke right now to end it in close.
Sometimes they come to both of us. They start at one and end up at another. Or start at one.
I look at what Chris is doing and I'm just like,
no, but they certainly come to us more now than they used to. Like, when we were just talking about this at another convention a week ago, when we went and pitched the Hasbro people on Transformers, nobody knew who the hell we were. You know, we were doing, I think we did CSI and we did, like, Steve Niles horror comics. So they go, why are you guys even here? You know, we're meeting with Marvel, we're meeting with all these other bigger publishers, why you? And we ended up winning them over with our approach and whatever else that, you know, ended up landing us the gig. And now I think by really... I think all of us do these licensed comics now that are so much better than they used to be.
Oh, yeah.
Like, they used to be treated as, who's not working on Spider-Man and the Avengers? All right, put him on, you know,
give it to Doug
Joe. Yeah, or Herb Trimpey, or, you know, all these guys that were more workmanlike, whereas for us, we're not putting our C-list talents. I mean, no offense to her, but, you know, we're putting the very best people we can on these things to do them as good as we can. So I think that has shown other people with licensed projects that they want to come to us, that we're going to do a very good job with what they've got to offer.
Yeah, a lot of them come to us, and we go after the ones that we're really excited about.
Sometimes we're fighting over them, and we don't know that we're bidding against one another.
And sometimes we do know.
Yeah, which makes it more fun.
But, yeah, I mean, we're the obviously great ones we are fighting over usually, and then there's a lot of stuff that comes to us, and they... like beg or insist or threaten or leverage, but yeah, there's a lot of different ways it happens. But you look at a show or a film or something that you love that you think's amazing, and then you get to think about what its life will be like as a comic. You know, somebody talked to us at one point. I think they didn't know what they were talking about, but someone talked to us at one point about doing Breaking Bad comics, and I was like, that is my favorite show, and that is a terrible idea. So we didn't do it.
So just very briefly, what sort of chaos? You guys
are
they
still around?
No, different chaos.
Oh, gotcha.
What kind of chaos is happens when people miss a deadline, justified or otherwise? I mean, there's always probably, at some point, especially in the larger groups, somebody missing a deadline. What happens and what's the ripple or domino effect
It's troubleshooting. I mean, like, there's a million different solutions. There's a million different approaches. Sometimes we make the decision this book's going to be late because we want to keep it, you know, the way it is. Or you look at what talent you can pull in to break it up. We got a book right now that's behind. Dark Horse tends, and you guys do the same thing. We tend to use a lot of penciler inkers. They do the same, you know, that one artist doing the whole job, penciling and inking. You get a book that's really behind like that, and then maybe you can pull in an inker, and suddenly you saved a bunch of time. There's a million different things. I know... Because Dirk has told me a lot about it. You guys have a system for making sure that you correct deadline problems quickly that I envy. It sounds awesome. It sounds brutal, and it sounds awesome, but it seems like you guys are very on top of it as a group. It looks like a schedule's going astray. You're in there.
Yeah, I mean, but then you hit times where you put a book out, and there was a different artist on issue 2 or 3, and you go, man, I know it came out on time, but this trade... I just like it less now because it's got different art styles in there. So you you do balance. Is a book like Lock and Key hasn't necessarily shipped on time every month the last year or two, but I would wait forever for that book. And there are certain people like that, that like Dave Sims' book is probably going to be a year and a half away before it starts, but there's people that have sort of earned that right and are talented enough to run late and then let us work on their schedules. There's others, if it's a book like Transformers, where there's numerous artists that can draw it, we'll bring in other people just to make sure it does happen on time. But it causes, you know, it causes the record of chaos in the office, and it also, depending on what the reason is or how communicative the artist is, you know, it can hinder your willingness to rehire that person, depending on circumstance.
Okay. Well, that communication thing, if they're communicating with us while it's going late, then that's way better than if they're not communicating or if they're clearly lying, making promises that they daily fail to make. That definitely affects your desire to work with them again.
Yeah, and you know, the way that our industry works, I'm not sure how many of you guys know this, but we solicit the books 3 or 4 months out. So then that goes on the production schedule, and then we have a date that we have to hit to get the work out. So we can work with slower artists, we can work with faster artists. In fact, I can do 4 or 5 pages a week, it's gold. But what you want to try to do is, you know, if you're missing deadlines constantly, you're not going to be there for long. You know, especially if you're not communicating with your editor. You know, it can create chaos, especially for a company like us at Valiant, because, you know, we're 18, 19 months old at this point in time. And a large part of what we were doing was just trying to show the retailers that we will hit our dates. And we haven't shipped late in 19 months. I have a whole host of gray hairs as a result of that. But, you know, we make sure that, you know, if we have to split a book up, you know, you can move to breakdowns from pencils and bring a finisher in. You can split up colors. It's not ideal sometimes, but, you know, usually sometimes that's what you have to do.
But in the days of inventory, I mean, when you were there, Warren, I wrote inventory for some of the assistant editors. Is inventory over?
I do something different. I mean, on all my monthly books, I do planned inventory. You know, like I do a one-shot. Okay, well, we got Kevin Nolan wants to do a single issue of this particular series. We're going to give him 12 months to draw it, and then probably it'll be issue 23 or whatever. We don't really do inventory stories, although Dark Horse Presents has inventory stories.
You guys know what inventory is? I mean, just as a point of reference, stories that are guys want to...
It's usually a story in the drawer that you can just slot in if a deadline runs that late. I hated that when I was a kid, though.
Yeah, 20, 30 years ago.
Most offbeat story of the year.
Well, yeah, the Assistant Editor Month was kind of fun. But, you know, you're reading a book that's got a nice story going, and it's like a reprint of an old issue. You're like, damn it.
Right.
I had a month for that. So we try not to do that. We just try and make sure they come out on time, no matter what.
Yeah,
it would be dropped into the run. Like, it would be a new cover of X-Men, and you go and you pick it up, and suddenly it was like X-Men, you know, 42,
yeah.
30 years ago. Right? You're like, what is this? But, you know, now our industry is different. We don't have the luxury of doing that, unfortunately. But, you know, as Scott was saying, what we'll do is we'll plan an annual or zero issue or a one-shot or something along those lines that thematically ties into the story so that we can work with a slower artist but still get it onto the schedule.
On Buffy Season 9, we were working with an artist who we'd worked with for a long time, Georges Genti. We knew exactly how things worked with him, and we communicated very openly and everything. We knew that he can't, like most artists these days, he can't draw a book a month. So we would schedule it, and we would write the stories around it. Like, we know that we're going to need a two-issue fill-in for issues 12 and 13, so we're going to plan that as a standalone two-issue story. We're going to write it to totally be self-contained. So even though in that trade paperback you will have two artists, there'll be a feeling of a break, and you'll have the feeling that, like, well, this is a different story, so that's why it's a different artist. Rather than, like, on page 12 of issue 11, suddenly a totally different art style comes in, which to me is terribly disruptive to the story.
And, I mean, you know, we're all fans of this stuff, and I think we all remember when books ship late, all your stuff from when I was a kid that shipped it 6 months late, that I still sort of remember that grueling wait. So I think we try hard, not only from a business standpoint, but just as fans, and to do right by our fans and the retailers, just to keep things happening on time.
Yeah, right. So the retailer orders something with the expectation that it will arrive, and then they sell it.
Well, and if a book, yeah, I mean, like you were saying about, like, proving the reputation of a 19-month-old company, if a book is shipping late, retailers order less. Yep. Like, it directly impacts orders. Unless it's a book like Lock and Key. But if you're doing Transformers, or if you're doing a Star Wars series with, like, a good team, but not a Brian Wood kind of team, that book ships late, and you just watch orders drop. So there's a huge, very concrete side effect to freelancers who are late.
It's still a superhero-driven industry, so I don't want to give retailers or fans or anybody reasons to gravitate back to that stuff if they think, well, this Transformers brand late, I'll just pick up another issue of X-Men or whatever it is. So I think, you know, we're all focused on not slacking off.
That's definitely your point about superheroes is true, but there's also just so many books. There's so many choices.
It's
so many books.
Forgotten about, yeah.
The way I look at it is like, every reader and every retailer, like, they're waiting until they have enough reasons to drop a given book.
Right. Yeah.
Never give them one more reason.
Right. Yeah. Everybody in this business wants to say no, right? So don't give
reasons. Not just us.
Yeah.
So on that note, I'm going to ask the guys to just tell us what they have coming up, what we should be looking for, and where they can find you. So Scott, you're up on the screen. Why don't you just tell us what to be looking for?
Season 10. Buffy Season 10 launches in March and April. Buffy number one and then Angel and Faith number one in April. We got New Serenity by Zach Whedon and George Argenti. The Mignola verse is biggest part of my day is the Whedon stuff and the Mignola stuff. I get to work with pretty good people. And in Mike's world, we're just destroying everything. We're actually the next big story coming up launches in January in BPRD. And we've been kind of hinting at the idea that New York is ruined. We get to see just how bad things are in New York, and it's awesome. James Herron is doing the interiors, Raphael Albuquerque covers, and it is just brutal what we've done to the Big Apple. It's really cool. We're knocking off cities left and right. It's incredible. My Abe book is continuing monthly. We got new work from Richard Corbin. In the last couple weeks, we've announced two new Terminator series, one written by Dan Jolly, one written by J. Michael Straczynski. So we've picked that license back up. We've had it before. Everybody's had it. but we're doing new stuff there. We got a lot of cool video game comics. Halo, Tomb Raider coming.
Dynamite just announced little Terminator comics, didn't they?
Probably.
If I can plug one more thing for Dark Horse, that fifth Beetle book down in their booth right now is so goddamn gorgeous.
Yeah, like Andrew Robinson.
Oh, thanks. My God. You should go look at
great
it.
Great book.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's the story of Brian Epstein, and it's a really beautiful... really beautifully told story, but man, the art, it's just incredible.
It's one of those books that, like, there's some that, you know, pass through. We have different conversations with creators that, you know, when they end up elsewhere, I'm okay. This is one that I would have killed to do. Like, it's so good looking.
Yeah, I just saw Rebecca and I was telling how beautiful.
Yeah.
So, Chris, tell us what we should be looking for.
Well, so we don't have a booth here, but we're doing a big panel tomorrow. It's primarily an artist edition panel, but it's also Darwin Cook's going to be on it. We have a special guest that I can't wait to bring into the room because... It's gonna electrify the room in a way that very few creators can. So I hope, you know, if anybody's around tomorrow, come to that panel because it's gonna be a very cool, very fun announcement. A couple other very unexpected announcements there. Otherwise, sort of carrying on, we announced this morning a Transformers G.I. Joe ongoing crossover series, but it's gonna be done very differently. It's gonna be done by Tom Scioli, who did the book Godland with Joe Casey, and he's doing that same style and feel on the Transformers book. So it's basically the G.I. Joe's on Cybertron in a, like, the most cosmic Jack Kirby-esque sort of way. It's very different from what we normally do on those kinds of things, so it's fun to... It's fun when you have the license for so many years, like with Star Wars.
They trust you.
You can play around more, yeah.
That sounds great.
Yeah, I mean, in addition to that, you know, stuff like Joe Hill's Wraith, like I say, is picking up after Lock and Key, which I still hate to acknowledge is ending, but... Gabriel's about three-quarters of the way through the final issue, and every page that comes in is just wrenching. Just knowing that it's ending, so it's nice to at least have another Joe project to fill that void.
Are you going to do any like big library kind of version of Lock and Key?
Oh yeah, it's kind of what you do when the series finishes, right? Now it's going to come out in every format. Oversized, undersized, mid-size. But yeah, I'm sure we'll do the omnibus format. We're talking about doing the big, you know, the Marvel sort of 1,000-page collection. And there's still some more Lock and Key to come. They're going to do some more one-shots, but... Yeah, the main story is ending soon, which I'm still sort of in denial about.
Did you guys just announce a one move from Cup thing also?
Did we announce that yet?
You
we're,
did, yeah.
We're
well, Rich announced it. I don't know if it's
yeah, leave it to Rich. But yeah, we're gonna Lone Wolf and Cub is gonna get a new deluxe format.
Oh, he announced the sequel too.
We announced that. Yeah, that's right. That's right.
Yeah, which is awesome.
Yeah, Koike is here at a panel. I think in this room later today, but with Wikia. But yeah, Kazuo Koike is here for a Masters of Anime manga panel.
It's like one of my heroes, man.
Yeah, he's incredible.
Have you read it?
And Warren, why don't you just tell us a little bit about what you're working on, what we should be looking forward to?
Our big initiative in November, we're launching our first team book, which is called Unity, which basically sees the Valiant universe taken to the brink of a nuclear war. Exo-Man War is about to basically cause a nuclear catastrophe. He tries to take over Romania, and Toya Harada, who's a Nimbo Harbinger, who's a child of the bomb, has vowed that will never, ever, ever happen again. So we have all of our big guns in one book, Exo-Man War, Harbinger, Bloodshot, Eternal Warrior. So we're pretty excited about that, and that goes on sale in November. And then we have Peter Milligan, the brilliant genius Peter Milligan, taking over Shadowgun, so we're super pumped up about that. We have a whole ton of other stuff coming up that we'll be announcing.
Who's that cover by?
Which one? The Roberto Della Torre.
What's that?
Roberto Della Torre. Gotcha. Done a beautiful job on the series as well. Very haunting, beautiful stuff.
Like, how good is the comics industry right now? I mean, I know the superhero thing is what it is, but I love being a part of comics with guys like this and doing these kind of books as alternatives to the regular superhero stuff.
Right. Yeah, we talk about that at the office all the time, but just how good it is right now and how many great books there are and how competitive it is, but just, you know, all the great stuff that you guys are doing, you know.
All right, guys, so before I give up the stage, two announcements. If you've been in the other panels, you know the same announcement. Everybody that comes here is doing this on their own time. Nobody gets paid special to come up on a panel. So the way to thank people is to buy their books. If you like what you've heard or you see something that sounds interesting, go out and buy the books. That leads to the second thing. Our industry is under siege from torrenting and sharing. There's no such thing as torrenting and sharing. It's stealing. And we make money book by book, issue by issue. Any issue that you get for free and steal takes the money out of the hands of the creators and the companies, and that makes it harder for them to publish books in the future. So please say no to torrenting. If you have anything on your hard drive that's been there, maybe you're on the fence about it, delete it, because that's the right thing to do. So please say thank you to our editors.
Take a quick group photo.
Everybody smile.
Ah, man, the guy in row 19 blinked. Hold on.
And also, just a quick note, if you stop by the line booth, we're handing out copies of the Unity preview. You guys should go check it out. It's awesome.
Thanks, everyone.